I'm going to discuss the last topic again in a very impressionistic way, and I'm going to be very sketchy, namely strings with space-time supersymmetry RNS formalism. And I would like to take the opportunity to say a bit more about what supersymmetry is, so to present a bit more about supersymmetry algebra. Now, so we have seen how to describe strings in the RNS formalism, and writing down an action was very easy, right? So because an action in the conformal gauge, because the coordinates that specify how the string is embedded in space-time simply appear as bosons in two dimensions, and they are vectors in space-time. And to this we are going, so these are free scalars. And to this we are going to add some two-dimensional spinners that carry the same vector index as the coordinates. So writing down an action was very easy. We just have to write down some two-dimensional fermions. Now, this made the construction of the action very easy. And we explicitly constructed the spectrum for open and for closed strings. We analyzed boundary conditions, so open strings, closed strings. So we constructed the spectrum. But then we did see immediately we did run into the disadvantages of this approach. Namely, we had to pay the price that these objects here carry this mu index that is a vector-like index. So it's not a spinner index, right? And then supersymmetry, space-time supersymmetry was not obvious in this approach. So space-time supersymmetry is not obvious. And we actually had to do something that was called the GSO projection. GSO projection that boiled down to projecting out some states in the spectrum, since, for example, the Taffian was there, and since the spectrum without the GSO projection was not space-time supersymmetric. Now, I mentioned that this GSO projection can actually, it's not just a rule that we set up in order to keep the state we want, but can be derived from modular invariants. Now, I promised that I would derive that, but it's probably not going to fit in the schedule, so I'm going to mention this, but maybe we can squeeze this in homework exercises, because, I think we have enough tools to at least understand why we need this GSO projection. Okay. Now, so let's talk. There's another approach. So this was this difficulties we ran into were related to the fact that we are using here objects that carry a vector-like index. Now there's a different way, and this is called the RNS formalism. There's a different way of writing down an action describe that is supersymmetric for strings, and that is called the GS formalism, and that incorporates directly space-time supersymmetry, as opposed to just watch it supersymmetry like here. So that is called GS formalism. Now, so let's go back to the basics. In order to describe the motion of a point particle, let's say, in three dimensions between points A and B, so we use an action like this, A, B, ds, right? Now, so this action should be invariant under Lorentz transformations, rotations, and translations. So it's invariant under Lorentz transformations, rotations, and translations under the Poincaré group. Now, what we are going to do is to two. Here we are describing the motion of this point-like particle in three dimensions. So we have three. We need three coordinates to specify this this point. What we are going to do is to add to this spinner-like coordinates. So we are going to describe. So what I want to discuss today is how to describe the motion of a particle like this, not in space, but in superspace. So superspace. So that's a generalization, of ordinary space. Or of ordinary, maybe space-time. So in which, so we of course still have the coordinates that transform as vectors of the Lorentz group, so this of the Poincaré group that transform as vectors of S or D minus one. Let's say we are in the dimensions one. But now what we are going to do is to add to this a new type of coordinates that I'm going to call theta. Now these objects are going to transform as spinners. Of S or D minus one, comma one. Now sometimes we may want, so this index over here labels the spinner components. Sometimes if there's supposed to be more than one supersymmetry, we also use an index A, so A can take values from 1 to n if we are talking about n supersymmetries. Now, so let's talk about the symmetries of superspace. Let's see, and let's start with symmetries, first of all, symmetries of ordinary space. So let's say we talk about, so one of the transformations are space-time translations, right? X mu goes over to X mu plus A mu plus some vector. Now, so if we write this infinitesimally, then any function can be expanded, depending on X, can be expanded like this. Plus something that is order, let's say A square. So in this case, A would be small. A is small. Or we can also write it like this. E to the I, A mu, P mu, acting on A. Now, so we say that P is the generator of translations, right? So P mu minus I, E by dx mu. Is the generator of translations. So they form a non-compact abelian group. So it's non-compact because A mu over here, so the shift can take values from minus infinity to plus infinity. So translations form a non-compact. So non-compact again means that A takes values from minus infinity to plus infinity, as opposed to, for example, if we consider rotations, then we would have an angle that varies from 0 to 2 pi. So that would be compact, right? So it's non-compact abelian Lie group. So abelian means that it doesn't matter in which order I do transformations. I first shift by A and then by B, or by B and then by A, so the order doesn't matter. So the corresponding Lie algebra simply is that the commutator is equal to 0. So this is one of the commutators of the Poincaré algebra. So just to get a little bit more, just to get a little bit more familiar with Lie algebras, let's do the same thing now for rotations. So let's compute the Lie algebra corresponding to rotations. So let's say I indicated this the other day. So let's say example one, if we are in two dimensions and we rotate these vectors, let's say by an angle phi, then v prime is equal to m times v, where m is equal to cosine phi minus sine phi cosine. Right? So then we can again assume that phi is small, and we can Taylor expand. So m in that case right? So we all know how to Taylor expand. That's equal to I phi. So let me pull out a factor of I over here. So that's usually done. Minus I zero plus order phi squared. Right? So again, so this is written as e to the I phi times s, so where s is the generator over here, s. Now, so this group is SO2, and this group again is abelian, because if I rotate by an angle phi 1 and then an angle phi 2, or I change the order of doing things, it doesn't matter. So it's again abelian. So it's abelian. Right? So this boils down to saying that the commutator of s with s, of course, is equal to 0. Now let's do this in a bit more, an example that is a bit more non-trivial, example two. Let's say we are considering now rotations in three dimensions. Now, are rotations in three dimensions abelian? No. OK. So we can see this in an easy example. Let's say, for example, we do two rotations over here. We start with a vector A. So we have three axes here, one, two, and three. We first rotate about this angle here. We call this alpha 3, about the axis 3. And then maybe about the axis 1. Let's call this alpha 1. Right? So then A becomes A prime. And A prime then becomes over here A double prime. So we first do it in this order. A becomes A prime. And then we rotate about alpha 1. This becomes A double prime, right? Or we do it the other way around. So if we first rotate about the 1 axis, so the vector, of course, doesn't change. It stays A. And if we then rotate about the 3 axis, we get A prime, right? So and they are not equal. So this shows that SO3 is non-abelian. But we can easily compute the Lie algebra for SO3, because then we have our three axes here, 1, 2, and 3, and then we can consider rotations instead of about the axis. Let me label these by saying in different planes. So I'm going to say that the matrix depends on ij, depending on whether it is in the plane 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, or 1, 3. And once we know how to rotate in two dimensions, we know how to rotate in three. Of course, for example, the rotation in the 1, 2 plane leaves the three axes unchanged. So it's going to be like this. Right? So it's going to be a rotation in two dimensions. There's a one here. We can do the same with our rotation in the 1, 3 plane. There, the two axis is going to be left unchanged. So then we have a 1 over here, 0, minus sine theta, 0, cosine theta. And M23 is going to leave the one axis unchanged. So 1, 0, 0, 0, cosine psi, sine psi, 0, minus sine psi, cosine psi. Okay. Again, we can Taylor expand. And we can write this three different matrices as an identity matrix again, plus I, and now there's a set of generators that carry two indices times delta phi, where these are the different angles, plus order delta phi square, right? And then, well, we get certain expressions for the generators of the rotation. So these are the generators. And, well, then we can compute the corresponding algebra. That would look like this. OK, so we have just verified that S of 3 is non-abelian. Now, so it should hopefully be clear that if we talk, so what are groups? So groups are certain transformations that we do in such a way that if I do two of them, so that it's closed under multiplication, right? So if I do two transformations, one after the other, I could do this as one single transformation. So this is sort of basically what a group is. Now, if we talk about, then if we represent a group element in this way, so the elements of the group, we write them in this way. So we have different generators, like different rotations about different in different planes, right? Then the condition that these objects form a group is that one transformation times another transformation, let's call it, for example, beta b, xb is equal to e to the I gamma c xc, right? So this means that if I do first this transformation and then this transformation, I can always write it in this way. Now, if you expand this infinitesimally, so this is the product rule that one uses for groups would be matrix multiplication. Now, if we do this infinitesimally, we would not talk about product of matrices, but we come to the conclusion that these objects have to satisfy Ali algebra, right? So that is sort of, we talk about Ali group if we talk about finite elements, and we talk about an algebra if we talk about the infinitesimal expansion. Okay. Now, so we just obtained the Lie algebra for rotations in three dimensions. But now it's easy to think about this and to generalize this to n dimensions. Namely, then we simply do the same thing. We would have vectors. And just a little bit of thought shows that this is the right way to do things, right? So then we have rotations in different planes. So over here, the planes were 1, 2, 1, 3, and 2, 3. Let's say we are in 8 dimensions, right? Then we have many more choices over here. So most of them, they're actually going to commute, right? So if I have my vector with entry v1 prime, v2 prime over here, let's say I'm in 8 dimensions, v7 prime, v8 prime. I write it as a big matrix times v1, v2, blah, 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 v7, v8, right? So if I do rotations in this plane, 1, 2, and 7, 8, they actually will always commute, right? So that's sort of obvious. And then the only possibility is, so if we describe rotations in n dimensions, is if they have one axis in common, so the planes in which we are rotating. So in n dimensions, or let's say, how do I call this, d dimensions. So the Lie algebra. Now we would talk instead of SO3 of SOD, would be like this. So this says that these rotations always need to have one axis. So the rotations in the different planes always need to have one of the axes in common, S, J, K. is ik minus delta jk si. So this is the Lie algebra for SOD. Now, we derived this in very much detail, so I'm just going to claim the results in the same way we can describe rotations, or we can describe, let's say, the Lie algebra of Lorentz transformations that would have different signature, SOD minus 1, 1, but I don't want to write it down. So it looks very similar, except that instead of delta, we would have an eta over here, so a few small modifications. And then we can obtain the Lie algebra for Lorentz transformations. OK, so this is part of the Poincaré group, right? So this is still part of ordinary space. Now we want to do something new because we want to talk about superspace. So in the same way as we describe translations in ordinary space, we can also consider translations of the spinor coordinates. So translations in spinor coordinates. So in this case, we would simply take our spinor theta. Let's say we are only talking about one of them. And shifted, so this would be a constant spinor. So instead of constant shifts, we would talk about a constant spinor there. Now, in order to get, it can be shown that in order to get something interesting, we at the same time have to shift also the vector-like coordinates in the following way: gamma alpha beta mu theta beta. Oh. Actually, I should stick to the Latin indices. I'm calling this A and B. Right? Now, so we're, these are the Dirac matrices, and A and B label the entries. Let's say we are, for example, in flat space. Now, so we can also write this transformations in the following way. So delta theta A is equal to epsilon A. Delta x mu is equal to epsilon bar gamma mu theta. Okay. So this is what is called a supersymmetric transformation. Now, so now it turns out that supersymmetric transformations are an extension of the usual symmetries of space-time. So what do I mean by that? So imagine that we do two consecutive supersymmetric transformations. So two consecutive supersymmetric transformations. Let's say one by epsilon 1 and the next one by epsilon 2. So let's say we do transformation 1, that gives theta A plus epsilon A 1. Then we do the second transformation. So then we shift again. So this is the same thing as if we would shift simply by the sum of these two objects. Now, if we do this for the bosonic coordinate, on the other hand, so we first do the first transformation. So that gives x mu plus epsilon 1 bar gamma mu theta. And now we do the second transformation. All right, so then we have to shift x mu. Now, epsilon over here is constant, so that doesn't really change. It's just a number, so I don't do anything with epsilon. Now, if I do the second transformation, I have to shift x mu over here, but I also have to shift this theta, right? So then I get two terms. All right, so if this term wouldn't be present, then we would simply say, well, if I do two supersymmetric transformations one after the other, then it's the same thing as simply doing one single transformation like this. We get, again, our supersymmetric transformation. But now we are getting this additional term over here. Since epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 are both Grassmann, well, this is an ordinary number, so they are not Grassmann. It's just a mu. So if I now assume I've done this infinitesimally and I look at the commutator, then the order of doing things doesn't matter for theta, but the commutator of the two transformations, so that it's called in delta 1 and delta 2. So that's a mu. So that is a translation of ordinary space. So it's a translation. This means that the supersymmetric transformations, they close up to a translation. So this means that supersymmetric transformations are a generalization of ordinary symmetries of space-time. So I do two supersymmetric transformations, and I get a translation. Now, supersymmetry is a generalization of symmetries of space-time. Now, and in the same way as there's an algebra that generates the Poincaré group, and we derived two of those commutation relations a moment ago, there is an algebra associated to the super-Poincaré group, in which we are going to have the same commutators, but more stuff that is related to the generator of supersymmetric transformations. Yeah, right. So this object over here is a parameter. It's Grassmann parameter, but it's a constant, right? So it's a global symmetry, right? So it's so nothing is quantized. So you can say epsilon, for example, if we talk about since we are talking about generators, we have to assume that epsilon is small. So it's something like, it's not written out explicitly usually. So it's like saying this is a Grassmann object and there's a small real number in front. So this real number is allowed to be very small. OK. Now, so let's compute the algebra of supersymmetry generators. So we know that ordinary translations, we just derived this a moment ago, are generated by this. Now we want so this is the generator of translations of simply saying x mu goes to x mu plus a mu. Now we want the generator of supersymmetry transformations. Now, so let's represent supersymmetry generators also by differential operators like this. So then what we are going to do is, so we start with a function now defined in superspace. So it would depend on the usual coordinates and on the spinor-like coordinates. Then we do a supersymmetry transformation. Well, we just have learned how to do that. So we are going to shift the bosonic coordinate like this. And we are going to shift the fermionic one, like this. And again, now we assume that epsilon is small, and we write down the Taylor expansion of this. So epsilon is small. Right. So then this is the leading term. That alpha should be A. Theta A plus, now over here, so this is a bosonic number, so this is not Grassmann. So I simply can apply Taylor expansion like this, gamma mu theta d phi by dx mu x theta. And then I have the shift over here, epsilon A d phi by d theta A plus dots. So we can also write this as so after a supersymmetric transformation goes over to phi plus epsilon a. So now I'm putting out this factor of epsilon a over here. So d by d theta a plus. So in this bar, we usually have this charge conjugation matrix in. So let me simply sneak it into the formula. A b theta b d by dx mu. Plus something containing more epsilon, right? Epsilon squared. Now, so this over here is the generator of supersymmetry transformations. So QA is the generator. Of supersymmetry, right? D by D theta A plus theta B, let's write it in this order, C, A, B, D by DX. Now this object over here, so these are Grassmann numbers. So we of course know how to deal with Grassmann numbers. So they are roots like this. They anti-commute. 1 is equal to 0. We can compute things like derivatives. Theta 1, theta 2 is equal to theta 2. Or if we do it like this, we get a minus sign. Right? So this means that once we know the generator of supersymmetry transformations, we can write down the corresponding algebra. So we write down the anticommutator and we see from here that so if we square this, then so there are there are two contributions when this derivative fits this theta over here, right? Using those rules. And here's the claim, this over here is equal to, so there are two terms, gamma mu AB P mu. So it gives an ordinary translation, as we have seen a moment ago, by interchanging the order of the transformations. Yes?
Yeah, so why did we have to do the charge conjugation?
That one was hidden in here, right? So each time we write down the Dirac conjugate here, so we have a charge conjugation here. So that's bar is usually defined as epsilon dagger rho zero or charge conjugation matrix. So it's not Dirac equation. Okay, now in the same way, so we have seen generators for translations There are rotations, there are Lorentz transformations. Now there is supersymmetry charge. Now we have computed now a few of those commutators, but if we compute them all together, we would get the super-Poincaré algebra. So we have in this way, we have an extension from the Poincaré algebra that describes symmetries of space-time to super-Poincaré algebra. So it's a generalization. So I'm doing this in an impressionistic way, so I'm not going to derive all of the commutators. But I think since we have discussed a few of them, so if you're interested, that's something that you can try to work out on your own. So super the Poincaré algebra. Poincaré algebra then becomes super. So which is extension. So by adding to this the supersymmetric charge. Now, on that sort of, maybe I should stop for questions. All right, so then since we now have, so I started this discussion by mentioning the point particle in d dimensions, that the action is invariant under Poincaré transformations. And now we want to do the same thing. I should actually ask something. Did you in the tutorials discuss how this type of superspace language is translated into the supersymmetric transformations we discussed for the RNS string? Did you discuss this in the tutorials? Right. Okay. Now we have seen. Now here's the point. So now we have seen that supersymmetry are shifts of the spinor-like coordinates. So we have seen supersymmetry in this form, right? Now when I talked about Wachit supersymmetry, I just presented the and I said, well, this action is invariant under this transformation, and this is supersymmetry. So I simply called this supersymmetry. So did you explain in the tutorials how this supersymmetry is related to the supersymmetry I discussed then? So by expanding maybe superfields and components and so on. But did you explain otherwise? Maybe this can be part of a homework exercise. So we could, of course. So all this discussion here was. I didn't specify the number of dimensions. So we can, for example, talk also about two-dimensional superspace, right? And then we would describe supersymmetry transformations like this. And then we could derive the transformations, the supersymmetry transformations acting on the spinors that we discussed back then, right? So the dx mu, epsilon, and so on. So we could derive actually this by expanding superfields in components. You did that? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. So well, I mean, then maybe we can because it's nice. I mean, to see a unified picture of supersymmetry, right? I mean, to see this description over here as a shift in superspace, and then you have this description here where the fields are expanded. So this are somehow comes from expanding a superfield in components and then reading of the supersymmetry transformations. I mean, maybe we can have one additional homework or something regarding this. But okay. Okay. All right, now, so we started this discussion by talking about the point particle and moving in some space and about an action that was minus d tau, right? Or not d tau, excuse me, ds, right? And that this action was invariant under Poincaré transformations. And now we want to write down an action for a point particle moving in superspace. Now, So now, let's see this one. So let's say we have our transformations. So we start, if we talk about the point particle like this, we can write the action like this, right? Square x dot d tau. Now, to write this in superspace, so we want something that is invariant on the super Poincaré transformations. Now, so here's the thing, the object that is, so we need an object that is invariant under the supersymmetric transformations. And the way to do that is to write an object that is called pi minus theta bar gamma mu. Now, so if I do a supersymmetric transformation like this, so then so this transforms to this over here gets a factor of epsilon, right? And this one, so this goes over to under supersymmetric transformations to itself mu plus epsilon bar gamma mu theta dot. Minus epsilon bar gamma mu theta dot, right? So that cancels. So that is invariant under supersymmetric transformations. And then there is a naive guess for the action of a superparticle. Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Oh. Yeah, sometimes I'm being a bit too sloppy. Okay. All right, so this is invariant under supersymmetric transformations. So there's a naive guess. That would be like this. Well, in order to write down the action for a superparticle, we are going to try something like this. D tau, so that is one term that has to be added. But now one can show, and again, so this is done in detail in the book, that one needs this term over here, but one needs an additional term that looks like this, theta bar gamma 11 theta dot. So gamma 11 is going to be, again, the product of gamma 0 to gamma 9. So it's the chirality operator, d tau. So this term over here is needed. So let me just say this word here is needed to have the right number of propagating degrees of freedom. So what this means is, so if you simply would take this action over here, so it would be invariant under the supersymmetric transformation that we just discussed. But suddenly, if you write down the equations of motion, then for the fermions, only a part of the coordinates actually appear. So other part actually drops out. So there is, in this part, there's a mismatch in the bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. And this is why one needs that term. Now, that's a generalization of this. So this for the string, and so this over here would be the, so this would be what is called also the D0 brain. So it's a point particle, according to the notation we used yesterday. So that's a point particle. So if instead of a point particle we talk about a string, the action would be somehow like this. So again, we start with the Nambu-Goto action. Now, so I'm being a little bit sketchy because in this part because I don't think it's going to be of much help to write down now all this long action because it's going to be, it has many nonlinear terms, and we are not going to learn much from them. So what I'm going to mention are the symmetries. So if we talk about the string, then we are going to take the Nambu-Goto action, and we are going to replace it by something like this. And there's, again, a second contribution that I don't want to discuss in detail. So G is the determinant of G alpha beta. And again, G alpha beta is the product. So that's contracted over the of this spacetime index and pi in this case. Now we have two Borchardt coordinates, so alpha can take values 0 and 1. Again, so this object is invariant under the supersymmetry transformations here, so the same argument as for the point particle. Now we need the second term in the action, again, to have the right number of propagating degrees of freedom. You already see that. So we can write it in this form, or we can also write it with an auxiliary matrix. So both things actually work. But you can see already one property, namely that the equations that we are going to get are highly nonlinear. So we can write it like this, plus the second term, right? But in the product of this pi here, you see already there is a term theta to the 4, right? So it's more complicated than the free fields we discussed in the RNS formalism. So this is sort of the disadvantage of this. I don't even want to write down S2. Now, and it turns out that this action has an additional symmetry that I'm just going to mention. That is called kappa symmetry. So there's an additional symmetry that is called kappa symmetry. So in addition to super Poincaré invariants, or invariants in the super Poincaré transformations, in addition to invariants. Now, you are welcome to, so all of these big formulas are in the book. You are welcome to, for example, take the action that is this, again, described in the book. You can write down equations of motion for theta and for x. You can check all the supersymmetry transformations and all the kappa symmetry and so on. But again, so it's highly nonlinear, and the equations of motion are much more complicated than in the RNS formalism. Now, one can, again, in this approach, choose the Lightcon gauge in order to quantize things. So to quantize, so again, we can choose again Lightcon gauge. And then basically the story is the same as for the RNS formalism. One can construct again. Now the advantage is in the Lightcon gauge, the action is going to linearize. And it's going to be very similar as in the RNS formalism, except now the indices that are in the fields are no longer vectors, but are spinors. So more details in the book. All right. Now, again, so there's this one additional topic that I wanted to discuss, but so I don't want to start. I want to start now. So it's the GSO projection, and I'm just going to tell you in which section to read about it. So again, so that is a topic. So we should already have all the tools available. So about the GSO projection, and modular invariance. Of while loop partition function. Now, it may be a bit too difficult to do the entire computation of the one loop partition function, but something that should be doable is to write the string to understand if we have a torus like this. For example, we write on a square torus, and we can choose boundary conditions along the different cycles, right? So we can choose plus or minus boundary conditions. Then these transform into each other under modular transformations. And something that should be doable is to understand how these boundary conditions are mapped into each other under modular transformations. Now, this computation is done in section 9.4 of G. SW, Green-Schwarz version 2, so if you're interested to read about this. So that's all I can do. All right, well, that's all I wanted to say. Questions? Yes?
Yesterday, when you were talking about factifying extra dimensions, how does that not break the Lorentz invariance that we desired, and does it change the number of the critical dimension by factifying a dimension?
It changes the, let's say it this way. When we computed the critical dimension, we talked about space-time having certain number of dimensions, something like counting number of fields, right? So let's say it this way. But this does not require any boundary conditions on the fields, right? So we can, for example, assume that some of this fields are periodic, right? So that's what we did. It fixes the number of them, but it doesn't tell you anything about the boundary conditions, right? And compactifying on a circle, what does it do? It's like saying you have this, right? And you periodically identify. So if this is 2 pi r. So you're still going to have the same dimension. You're still going to have the field, but you're changing the boundary conditions. Yes?
Here we're bringing class data science. That wasn't just a gauge trick.
Is that what?
That was not just a gauge trick, right?
Which was a gauge
trick? In class data science. What are we doing?
Oh, no. That's not that.
So do you think it's a more complicated one?
Well, I mean, so of course that things become more complicated. I mean, this is basically the reason why we did this. So we are seeing space-time as something that is flat, and the graviton is a small fluctuation, right? Now, so one way of looking at this is to say that we have looked at these objects here as free fields, right? But if you say you have a metric over here, so you have arbitrary space like this, then you would have an object like this. This would depend on x. Then you can have more stuff, but this is, for example, one thing that you would have. And then you would have kinetic terms that depend suddenly on coordinates, so you can describe any metric, for example. And then you're dealing with no longer a free field theory, but one with this object that appears. So from the two-dimensional perspective, maybe there are like coupling constants, right? And then you have to solve for the field theory in order to find what the equations are for objects like this in order to derive, for example, Einstein the equation or whatever. So they appear as coupling constants, and you no longer have free fields. But the story is, of course, much more complicated.
So when we turn on graphing with this G here, is this G the same that appears in our spectrum?
In the spectrum? OK, good. Now, in the spectrum, what we have done is basically to say this is eta plus h. Right? So we have something like saying that we have a weak field expansion that we say. So at this moment, we have seen it in the spectrum. And then what we do is a fluctuation about flat space. So to leading order, this is flat. And then we look at the fluctuations over here. Right? So here, if we just write it like this, then we would say, well, this is not a small fluctuation, but it's a metric, right? So, I mean, there's, of course, a whole an entire story to write about this nonlinear sigma models, where there is a metric here. I mean, it's a whole different story. More questions? So if there are no more questions, it was fun teaching you. See ya.